ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hey there, Sana Qadar here from All in the Mind. Check out our new series, Forensic. It's all about the psychological tools and tricks that come with investigating crime.
He was setting the bombs off in subways, in the New York Public Library, in movie theaters.
When you're testifying in court, rather than having purely your own memory, you take on all these little bits and pieces of information from different sources.
All in the Mind, Forensic. Search for All in the Mind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Gadigal land. I'm David Marr. Last year, the journalist Antoinette Latouf, in a blaze of publicity, won a case against the ABC for unlawful dismissal. She's now published an interesting book that puts her case in the context of battles by other Australian women, lone battles for the most part, against power, hoping for change. Antoinette Latouf later. We'll also travel to Cannes, hectic as usual at this time of the year for the opening of the film festival. It's 50 years since Australia officially joined the celebration. But times are tough, and this year we have no film in competition. Australia in and out of Cannes later. But first, to those strange islands of Great Britain, where the King, surrounded by page boys, has just read out the agenda of the Starmer government, which might last as long as tomorrow. Thank God we have Ian Dunt to tell us what's going on. Ian, what is going on?
It's extremely chaotic. It's very, very hard to have any sense of what's about to happen at any given moment. Because basically everything, when you get to this point, which, you know, if you've lived through British politics for the last 10 years, comes like approximately an 18-month cycle. It's basically the death cycle of a British prime minister. Everything becomes about herd movement and momentum. And so the consensus shifts almost sort of hour by hour. Is he going to go right now? Is a challenge happening right now? Oh, maybe Keir Starmer's completely safe. Yesterday morning, absolute chaos in Westminster. And it really felt like it was teetering on the brink, like he was about to go. And by the time of the afternoon, suddenly everyone was like, oh, look, looks like he's safe for a while. That's still what they were saying this morning. There was a meeting with Wes Streeting, the health secretary, and one of the people representing the right wing of the party who's looking to replace him. And after that meeting, Streeting's allies put out to journalists, well, you know what? He's probably going to go for a leadership challenge tomorrow. And so suddenly, at this precise second, everything is again up in the air, and it looks like Starmer might be facing real difficulties tomorrow. But, you know, give me an hour or two, and I'm sure the situation would have changed completely.
But there are two contenders, if I'm right. You know, neither of them are big figures. One of them is this guy Streeting, who's, as you say, is the right of the Labour Party. Another guy called Andy Burnham, who's been mayor of somewhere, Manchester, and he tried to get back into the House of Commons recently, and the Labour Party blocked him.
Yeah, it's the National Executive Committee of the Labour Party, which is sort of the brain of the Labour Party, the decision-making body. Like anyone that even comes into remote contact with the Labour Party considers it one of the most poisonous and unpleasant psychological and emotional experiences of their life. It is basically just a tribal knife fight, and it has been for 125 years for the entirety of its existence. And the vast amount of attention, political attention, that takes place in the Labour Party is not against the Conservatives. It's not really for how you govern the country. It's for who has control over the NEC, the National Executive Committee. And at the moment, the Starmerites have had control over that. So then when Andy Burnham, he's a figure from the soft left, really quite respected, I think quite an impressive individual, tries to say, well, look, I don't want to be Manchester mayor anymore. I want to get back into parliament so I can, you know, stand to be leader. Starmer's allies blocked him in the NEC. However, that in future is going to become much harder for them. Because today, all the trade unions affiliated with Labour, so not just the sort of much more militant left-wing troublemaking ones, but also the really quite moderate ones that were usually more sympathetic to Starmer, put out a joint statement basically saying we're not expecting Starmer to be the person that takes Labour into the next election. And they have votes on the NEC, along with local parties and a few other figures. That means that things have probably changed. And actually, there's a pretty clear route, you know, at least through the NEC for Burnham into Parliament. He still has to find a seat, a by-election, fight it, he has to win it. So it's still not a done deal. But that particular problem seems to have gone away for him.
How accurate do you think is Corbyn's analysis of what's gone wrong with Starmer that he published the other day? I'll just read a paragraph of it. The government chose not to bring in wealth taxes, not to implement rent controls, not to make the kind of public investment in council housing that's needed to tackle the housing crisis, and chose not to distribute resources from those who wield it to those who need it. Is that a fair summation of the attitude of the Starmer government?
No, this is just the classic Corbyn. I mean, Jeremy Corbyn, like former leader of the Labour Party, has only one way of appraising any situation, which is to revert back to the ideological views that he has held for the last 60 years and has never been able to change or to grapple with or to criticise in any way, shape or form. So look, he's obviously going to say, he was always going to say that Starmer failed because he wasn't left-wing enough. That's just what the take he's going to have. The problem with the Starmer government has been that it doesn't provide anything on any possible quality that you might ask of a government. So is he a charisma powerhouse? No, obviously not. People weren't expecting that. Is he a great soaring storyteller that can explain to people the future of the country and what he's trying to achieve? No, people weren't expecting that either. They knew he was this kind of humdrum sort of provincial bank manager type, but they expected him to be serious, to be policy orientated, to work diligently to deliver for the public. And in fact, that last part is what we didn't get. He was sort of perpetually uninterested in policy. No matter what you presented him with, he just seemed rather bored of it all. He wouldn't really make decisions between government departments, and that freezes up the whole British political machine. So, for instance, we need more spending on defence. Everyone understands it. America is no longer a reliable ally. We clearly don't have the NATO umbrella in any meaningful way. There needs to be much more spending. But the Treasury doesn't really want that much more spending because it's concerned about the national finances. In that scenario, when you've got the Ministry of Defence and the Treasury basically in a dispute, you need a Prime Minister that will step in and say, well, this is the way we should go. Instead, what we get is statements from Starmer basically going, oh, isn't it funny how they're having a dispute? As if it's like, do you know whose job it is to deal with these scenarios and to actually make the call? He just won't do it. And it's that part, the failure in policymaking, that's the bit that's really got it. Not so much the sort of things you hear from the right of, oh, he's not right-wing enough, and the things you hear from the left of, he's not left-wing enough. It's much more basic than that. It's that he has failed at the job of governing.
So he dithers.
He did this. He can't seem to make a decision. And most importantly, he refuses to accept political pain. You know, I mean, at the moment, that started really in opposition, where he basically said, look, we're not going to raise any taxes. We're going to support conservative tax cuts. Now, that has just strapped him in an economic straitjacket for the whole of his time in government. So, in fact, Britain pays more for its national debt because its finances look so tenuous. And the reason the finances look so tenuous is because he refuses to raise the taxes. So over and over, he takes these decisions. They stop him spending more. They stop him solving anything like social care or defence or any other area that you look at, special educational needs. They make the debt more painful. And all of it transpires because he just wouldn't take the pain. He wouldn't take the hit of saying, no, we have to be realistic about tax rises, or we have to be realistic about opposing Tory tax cuts. Now, you can see exactly the same process when he talks about Europe. He did a speech on Monday saying Britain is going to be at the heart of Europe. What does that mean? Well, it doesn't mean join the EU. It doesn't mean the single market. It doesn't mean the customs union. It basically means nothing. And the reason it means nothing is because he won't accept freedom of movement. He won't accept a full youth mobility scheme. Again, it's this fear of immigration. He won't take a hit on immigration. He won't take a hit from the right-wing press warning about immigration. And because of that, he has no Europe policy. So you look across the portfolio, and because of his fear of political pain, he's unable to actually secure any political advantages.
I wonder whether the common challenge in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia is reversing the tax cuts of the 1980s and 1990s in order that there be enough money to govern.
Yeah, I could actually go a bit further than that, I think, and it's... It's the political attitude towards taxation. And at least in the UK, since Thatcher, and since the specific forms of Labour election loss in that period, it has become a political truism to say you can't win an election while raising taxes. So in the best case scenario, what you get is every party promises tax cuts at an election. They raise taxes or don't do the tax cut in the middle period in between elections, and then they go back. Now we're in an even worse scenario than that, which is that they don't even do the middle bit. They actually stick to the election pledge. And sticking to the election pledge is a complete disaster. So at the moment, we just do not have the money. And there's no realistic conversation with the public about what it would look like to try and get the money. Instead, what you get is a whole series of right-wing promises on laissez-faire that the economy will be fine as long as we cap taxes even more, the kind of thing that Liz trusted, with disastrous effect. Or the kind of snake oil promises of the far left. Well, actually, no, almost right now, almost the entirety of the British progressive left, typified by the Green Party, that says, well, we can have everything we need as long as we just tax 50 billionaires. And you think, no, the truth is, it is not that simple. You can't just tax 50 billionaires. You have to be able to tax the middle classes and even the working classes more, a penny on income tax, maybe 2 pennies on income tax. And yes, obviously much more taxation on assets like capital gains to try and balance things out. But that kind of realistic conversation on tax, both on what it would look like and on people's willingness to pay it, that just simply isn't there in national debate. And until it's there, we'll end up in the swamp that we're in right now.
It's a conversation too terrifying to actually have.
Yeah, well, it's, you know what? There's that old Napoleon quote, right? Of like, if you show me what the world was like for a man when he was 20 years old, I'll tell you his worldview. And I think that's essentially what it is for so many politicians with their memories of the Thatcher period, the Blair period. It was just terror of like, the one thing you don't do is say that you're going to have a tax rise. Like, you just never, ever do it. And on that basis, we're still stuck in that straitjacket. And Britain in particular, what you're looking at is policy failure across the portfolio, like I said, from defence to immigration to welfare to social care, on the basis of a refusal to have a realistic conversation about tax.
But look, I think you paid not sufficient attention to the speech of the King tonight because, and I quote, there's going to be a fair deal for working people. The King said so. I mean, this is the programme of a government of extraordinary humanitarian concern and decency, surely.
It might actually, I mean, it is one of the most obsolete, absurd King speeches I've ever seen. And that includes the one that Boris Johnson did essentially as an Amdram performance in order to use up time ahead of Brexit. It's just, and everyone sort of knows it. It's like, you know, the King knows it. I mean, the palace have actually been quite, you know, reports emerged yesterday of the palace being pretty, pretty peeved at feeling like they've been roped in to make it politically useful for Keir Starmer to have a day of non-party political movement where people can't really express what they really think because it looks like it challenges the dignity of the King. Palace aren't happy. Everyone knows that this legislative agenda just won't get through. And no one expects Keir Starmer to get another year, let alone the kind of 2 years that it would require in order to implement it. So it's a sort of, it's like a daydream. It's like a sort of King's speech daydream. And even then, you look at the content, and we don't really know what's in these bills yet. As he just sort of outlined, he basically just describes them. You find out what it actually entails a little bit later on.
Yes.
But all of the ideas that are being thrown out there are basically exactly what Keir Starmer was talking about before. We're going to have a voluntary ID scheme. We're going to have alignment with Europe on sanitary and phytosanitary goods. I mean,
social harmony. There's going to be social harmony. The King said so.
It's going to be social harmony. And there'll be world peace because we can legislate for that in Britain now. And so, you know, it's a real, I think anyone looking at that legislative proposals thinking this is Keir Starmer's great big change he's going to implement in order to provide a sense of direction and idealism and drive towards his administration would be very disappointed. But of course, no one like that actually exists. Because I don't think at this point anyone expects that of him.
Ian, is he the kind of man that will hang on for grim death, you know, regardless of how undignified it might be?
Yeah, I think so. I'm disappointed to say that I think so. I think there was a chance yesterday. He had a cabinet meeting yesterday where I think Because in these scenarios, look, there's a bunch of formal leadership rules. You've got to have this many MPs to trigger, blah, blah, blah. But the reality of what it usually comes down to is it's usually up to cabinet. Cabinet will basically sit there. And if you get a situation where you've got the foreign secretary and the home secretary and the deputy prime minister, all three of whom apparently think it should go, if they just stand up there and go, look, I'm telling you right now, come up with a process or else I'm going to quit, the prime minister kind of has to quit. Like, you can't survive that level of seniority in the ministers that are leaving. And there was a chance to say, well, let's just have a proper process. Like, for God's sake, don't do some quick switcheroo to someone in just this typical Westminster chaos and just see if someone else works. For God's sake, wait for Burnham to get in. There can be a proper conversation in the Labour Party and maybe even the country about taxation, about what you do about capital gains, about the fiscal rules, about what you're doing on defence. You could have that take place over the summer with the decision in the autumn. The incentives of those in Labour who want Burnham back coincide with the incentives and the interests of the country and having a proper political conversation about the future and where we're going. That can take place. Instead, Starmer basically pushed all of that away and basically said, trigger a formal process or I'm not going anywhere. And basically what he said is, it's a pub fight. You know, you're going to have a pub fight with me. I'm going to challenge you. You come forward. I'm going to go down into the ditches. We'll all bleed out here on the floor. That idea of something with a bit more decorum, a bit more patience and a bit more dignity, a longer process, it looks like he's turned his back on it. And I think that was a mistake for him. I think he would have been thought of more highly in retrospect if he'd chosen to approach it that way, rather than just getting down into the mud and having a fight.
Is the best thing going for Starmer at the moment the fact that the only contender in the House of Commons is a right-winger, Wes Streeting?
He has an awful lot of opponents. I mean, basically, the majority of people in the Parliamentary Labour Party think he should go. However, they are not united. They are not united on who they think should replace him. For a start, some of them think Streeting, some of them think Burnham, some of them like Rayner, some of them even like Ed Miliband. There are other options there. And then they're also, because of that fact, not united on the process. Yes. And I think that second part is the really dangerous part. Because Burnham isn't in Parliament, some of them want the process to happen quickly. They're the Streeting guys. They're just like, let's just get this done before Burnham can get back. Some of them, if they support Burnham, want the process to take much longer so that Burnham has a chance to get back into Parliament. And because they're not united on the process, I think the process is just as important as the candidacy, they're quite split. And Starmer can use that to sort of muddle his way through. And if he has a short-term survival pathway, it's on precisely the basis of that. However, even if he survives short-term, he's not surviving long-term. Like, you just can't survive this level of political damage. You can't survive with like a third of your parliamentary party, over 100 MPs, saying they don't think you're up for the job. You can't survive as a Labour prime minister when all of the trade unions that are affiliated with the party are saying you're not up for the job. You can't survive if you've got your own cabinet secretary sounding off to the press, in private, in public, to your face. You just can't do it. So if it isn't this, I still think it probably will be this, but if it isn't this that does him, it'll be some more minor scandal, a more minor news story in 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 2 months. That'll be the thing that finally collapses him. Either way, that I can't see. I'd say with some confidence, it's very hard to believe that there's any kind of medium-term or long-term future for him as Prime Minister.
Ian, thanks as always for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Ian Dunt, columnist with iNews, about the situation right now in the United Kingdom. Coming up, the women who inspired Antoinette Latouf. Antoinette Latouf took the ABC to court in 2024 after being sacked for no good reason from a brief radio gig. One woman against a $1 billion public corporation before a judge. She won a mighty victory in the end, cash, costs, and a declaration from the court that the ABC had abjectly surrendered, those were the words of the judge, abjectly surrendered to a pro-Israel lobbying campaign. But Latouf admits that along the way she often doubted she could hold her ground, as she was paraded through the courts and the tabloids. So she began seeking inspiration and fortification from stories of women who, she writes, had been through their own wars, who'd spoken, resisted and been punished, but prevailed. The result is her book, just published, Women Who Win, Celebrating Courage, Conviction and Change. One of its themes is extraordinary, perhaps unique. Women meeting their adversaries as she did in court. In its way, the book is an anthem to the possibilities of radical change through litigation. But there's much more to it than that. Antoinette joins me now. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you for that really lovely and warm introduction.
Antoinette, what was it in the lives of these women that gave you inspiration and fortification? What were you looking for?
I was really looking for an IV drip of courage. I needed to, in so many moments, draw on their strength and experiences to keep going. And some people have said to me, oh, why did you focus on other women? Why did you just not focus on yourself? At the time when I started writing, there was far too much attention and headlines about me. And to be honest, I wanted to shift the focus away from me. And there are many women in this book whose stories are not well known. I mean, some are well known, but many are not. But really, I wanted to know what it was that kept them going in often really lopsided battles where they were up against a Goliath, or they were trying to change or test something that seemed insurmountable. And at the time, people were telling them they were mad. They were never going to win. They should stop.
But they didn't, and they prevailed.
Yes.
It is a very elegant construction. So your case is there as a kind of backbone to the book, and the lives of these other women sort of attached to it.
Mm. And it was all happening in real time, and so I started researching this book before my federal court trial. I was in between the Fair Work Commission and the federal court. And to be honest, at that point, I didn't even know if we would go to court. The whole time I was hoping we would settle. I mean, nobody really wants to take an enormous institution to federal court. And I have for so long loved and revered the ABC. I certainly didn't want to face off in a live stream trial. And I guess there's a real honesty in the way the stories are told and as my relationship develops with these women as they share their stories, because I have no idea how my story is going to end. And I don't know what my victory will look like, but I knew I would be victorious in one way or another. And that may sound a little bit mad to people who are going, well, no, you could have really lost in court. But the book's also an examination of what it is to win, because it's a really fraught and sometimes unfair notion, because sometimes
winning.
Because sometimes the cost is so high and the cost is so steep, or that you don't really get to revel in your win or enjoy your victory, or it's just a stepping stone for others who come after you.
The win can just be relief.
Yes. Yes. I mean, it was a relief, but it wasn't a resounding beat my chest type of win. I don't want to win against, again, an institution that I think is really important for our democracy. And I also didn't know what my life looks like on the other side of that win. I still don't really know what my life looks like on the other side of that win. And that's something that a lot of women in my book also felt, that, you know, they won, but they also had to, in many ways, redefine themselves and figure out what to do next.
Do you think people just simply do not understand the particular terror of litigation?
Oh, my gosh. I would say that I would honestly not wish it on anybody. This was probably the moment that was most terrifying for me. And as someone who'd never had any experience in with the law, when I was told that I may be slapped with a costs order, and that's when the court makes an order that you have to pay costs. And if I lose, yes. And at that point, my barristers were trying to discourage me from continuing to go forward. They're like, you never know how things play out in court. You never know how they go. We can't guarantee a win. We think we've got a good chance, but Antoinette, you could be up for in excess of $1 million in legal fees. What are you going to do then? And I really had to contend with that. And I made a $2.6 million gamble to just keep going. And I mean, that's terrifying and also a little bit insane that I did that.
Yes, yes. But I mean, I've been involved in some litigation, nothing on your scale and absolutely no publicity or anything like that. But I found that the fact that it was all going to come in the end down to the opinion of one person sitting on a bench is peculiarly terrifying.
Yes, it is terrifying. What I found a little bit comforting, though, which is a strange thing to find comfort in, when I realised or when I learnt that it was going to be live streamed, it was easier for me to understand that this was something for all Australians who are either interested in the law or interested in public broadcast or independence, and that I was also, I guess, sort of galvanised or comforted by the fact that the court of public opinion carried weight as well. And when things are live streamed and documents are available online and all of the affidavits and all of the emails and all of the evidence that was tendered, that in many ways enabled me to go, well, it doesn't necessarily matter just what one person thinks, because I really wanted this in, I thought it was of such public interest that it would be worth it irrespective of only if I half won or if the judgment wasn't favourable, because there was just too much, I thought, the broader Australian public ought to know.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Antoinette Latouf about the book she has just published, Women Who Win, Celebrating Courage, Conviction and Change. Antoinette, one of the things I loved seeing popping up here and there in the book were women who found themselves taking on these enormous, enormous fights. Before they kind of even realised they were doing it. They were some way down the track before they realised what they'd committed themselves to. Very happy to continue fighting. But I love the way it sort of steals over somebody that they're in this mighty stoush.
Yes, and that's was a bit of a common thread. So few people thought that they would be a trailblazer, change the law, set a precedent, be the first to, it could be anything like be the first to be allowed to compete in the Olympics as a woman. They didn't really understand the magnitude of what they were doing. All but one woman in my book says that they would do what they did again, which I think is really interesting and really powerful.
Yeah, but that's because they won.
I mean, fair. But not all of the wins are resounding. Not all of the wins are resounding, and some of the wins were wound back. And so it's not all, you know, cheers and backslapping for all of the women. But yes, even with myself, I didn't realise what I was doing or the magnitude of what I was doing. I just knew what my true north was, and I kept going. Initially, I'd sent an email to my managers going, oh, I think can you please explain what happened? And I just thought it would all be fixed up. I think this it's a real celebration of women's resolve and commitment despite the odds. And even if they were in a little bit too deep when they realised, oh my gosh, the extent of what they were doing, and they continued nonetheless.
One of the women you write about is Janice Duffy, who takes on an opponent infinitely more formidable than the ABC. Tell us her story.
Oh, Janice Duffy is incredible. So she was at the time, a public servant. She worked as a researcher. She's an Adelaide-based woman. And she ended up taking on Google and winning and doing it twice. And so in the particulars of her case was that she had some horrible things written about her online on a website because she was bringing to the public attention that there was meant to be like a psychology or a counselling support service that was actually exploiting people and taking their money, and the people behind this service online weren't actually accredited. They were scammers. And when she raised the alarms, she had been scammed. She was in a vulnerable position. She had been scammed. And when she raised the alarm, those who were behind this scam went on a internet blitz to defame her. And she argued that Google had an obligation to remove those posts online, because if anybody Googled her name, Dr. Janice Duffy, the fact that she was all of these apparently awful things, a psychopath, a stalker, this, that, and the other were the first things to come up. And she said, well, this is going to impact my reputation and my future career prospects. So she, like me and like so many other women, thought, you know, if you just ask politely, maybe these organizations will do the right thing. So she writes to Google and she explains the situation, but Google doesn't do anything and she gets ignored. And so then she ends up taking Google to the Supreme Court of Australia, Court of South Australia, sorry. And she was a self-represented litigant because she'd run out of money. She'd lost her job and she'd run out of money for lawyers. And so she had a secondhand binder and she went and bought an old printer and she won this landmark case, and she became the first Australian to establish that a search engine could be liable for publishing defamatory material. And so then Google was ordered to pay damages. A few years later, some of those search results started to reappear, and then she sued Google again, and then she won. And this is all while representing herself. And so, and I said to her, like, why did you, what was it about this that you just, you wouldn't back off no matter, and back down no matter what happened? You know, she'd run out of money, she'd lost work, she'd lost friends. And she said that it was, she was just made to feel like she was nothing. She said, Google made me feel like I was worth nothing for so long, and I am worth something, and they underestimated me. And incredibly, when I came across her work, because I was looking at sort of defamation law and different parts of law in Australia, I come to reach out to Dr. Duffy, and it turned out when I went to X to find her, because I couldn't find her anywhere else, I sent her a message, and then I realised she had reached out to me 8 months prior and wanting to support me because she had seen in the public what was happening with me. And she said, you know, I understand what it's like to take on an institution that underestimates you. And I remember her words, like, you have to beat the bastards. I literally beat the bastards. And so she continues to be this, you know, incredibly supportive woman who just wants to help other people who feel that they've been mistreated.
Antoinette, did she establish a precedent that other people can use to get Google to take stuff down?
She did. She did indeed. She did indeed.
Right. So they will now, on request, take material of this kind down?
I mean, they should, but she had to sue for a second time, even though she set the precedent in the first case. So in theory, yes.
Had you, before your own troubles in court, ever thought of the law and courts as a way of achieving radical change?
I mean, I knew it was possible, but I'd never really spent a lot of time thinking about it. And I certainly hadn't spent a lot of time thinking about how it had been used throughout Australian history. And I want to point out, although you did allude to it earlier, this is not a book about facing off in court. There are a whole bunch of different wins and challenges that have nothing to do with court. I hadn't, but I'm seeing, particularly in recent years, the importance of an independent judiciary and the court system in challenging things when power needs to be held to account. And so I have increasing interest in that area. Although, I would hope I never have to go through something like that again.
But your case achieved change at the ABC.
I hope so. Do you think it did?
The ABC isn't going to buckle to that kind of lobbying anymore.
Yeah, I hope not. And more broadly, it set a precedent in employment law. It was the first time political opinion as a protected attribute was tested in the court. So we knew it was a kind of a risky thing to do, but a very important thing to do, especially now in this political context, to test just how much that is a protected employee right. And the other thing is, I was a casual employee. So in workplaces with increasing casualisation, employees often feel, and rightly so, that they have even less rights or less right of recourse. So, it was significant in that regard as well.
Now, tell us about the case of Amal Nasser.
Yeah, so Amal Nasser is a Palestinian Australian, and we hadn't actually met until actually after my court win. And Amal is part of Palestine Action Group, and she was one of the applicants that essentially challenged New South Wales Police when they didn't want the March for Humanity, that's what it was called, over the Harbour Bridge last August. And that was a significant win because at a time there was a lot of, a lot of sort of competing narrative and competing interest. It was like a public safety versus the right to assemble and the right to and to protest on something as significant as the Harbour Bridge.
And the prerogatives of traffic, Antoinette.
Yeah, of course. We cannot inconvenience people who want to go across the bridge on a Sunday. It was really significant because it became a bit of a flashpoint for that tension between civil liberties, political expressions, and the boundaries of protest in modern Australia. But on that day, she was part of a team that enabled 300,000, and I was there, people to walk across the Harbour Bridge. It was cold. It was wet. There was all walks of life. It was the largest anti-war demonstration that this country has seen in decades. And I think it was very, very sort of significant to push back against what has been a growing and quite a concerning crackdown on the right to protest. I mean, a lot of the laws that have been targeting protests were in response to climate protesters and the environmental movement, but we've seen in recent years how this has been used and weaponized against those who want to show concern or use their civil liberty of protests. Like we just saw with Chris Minns that his restrictions on protests...
The Premier of New South Wales.
Yes, the Premier of New South Wales, that his restrictions on protests when Israeli President Isaac Herzog was here were actually unconstitutional. And so what was significant about Amal and her story was using her fight for civil liberties and the right for people to voice a political opinion about human rights atrocities and doing it in such a significant way. I mean, those pictures were beamed across the world.
Yes.
And that will be something that will be remembered for decades, the sorts of people and just how many people came together on that bridge.
But for me, I just am sort of in awe of the fact that that bridge march was allowed by a court. You know, when I was a young man, it was just unthinkable. And here is the use of the courts as a way of achieving an outcome like this. Mm. But it doesn't always work. I mean, you know, the courts then said no to the demonstrations at the time, as you were saying, of President Herzog.
Mm.
Antoinette, there is something that you just skate over that I'm not going to allow you to skate over.
Okay.
Because on about, I don't know, page something or other, you write and provide a footnote, women are more likely than men to participate in protest activities. Now, that is a fascinating thought.
Mm.
Therefore, we are talking about the sex most likely to fight, aren't we?
Yes, and then also in light of just how many anti-protest laws have been passed over the past two decades, they're more likely to bear the brunt of arrests or, you know, being targeted or maligned in the media. And so I didn't realise this until I started researching. So it's women at the forefront of, it can be anything from First Nations rights or whatever it is, like often advocating or assembling for important issues that usually affect marginalised or minoritised communities or people with less power. And it's given that women are more likely to be participating, and like we saw with Amal and Laura Davi, who I also profile earlier in the book, Laura became the first person to be prosecuted under new anti-protest laws that were introduced by a Labor government a few years ago. And so, I mean, we don't have all of the evidence, but it's not, because it's these things are still unfolding, but it's not too long a bow to draw that women are likely to be those who are mostly impacted by the crackdown on protests as well.
The story of Marawa Johnson, I found it inspiring that to be reminded that she first had a big defeat. She learned how to fight when she was beaten. Mm. She was beaten in a fight with Adani about the Carmichael mine in Western Queensland. But then she turned her attention to the next mine. Tell us about that fight.
Yes, so Marawa Johnson, she's a Wurundjeri woman from southeast Queensland, and she was, I think, only 19 years old when she began organising and, you know, representing her community. As you said, she had one big sort of significant loss, but she was like, right, onto it. What do we learn? Let's keep going. And she challenged the Waratah coal and its proposed Galilee Basin coal mine. And at the time, it was the first time in Australian history, in Queensland in particular, that they invoked the Human Rights Act to argue against sort of the impacts of what was Clive Palmer's proposed mine, how that would impinge on the intrinsic human rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who have connections to the land in a way that other Australians do not. And so it was the finding was really significant because it found that if that mine was allowed to be built, the devastating impacts on the environment would violate the human rights of First Nations people and worsen climate change at the same time. But it was the human rights of First Nations people and invoking the Human Rights Act, which hadn't been used before. So it was incredibly significant. She was heavily pregnant at the time of the, I think halfway through the trial, she was heavily pregnant. She went off, she gave birth the next day, and by the time she came back with the judgment, she was holding her daughter when the judgment was in their favour. And then she's continued to build on that precedent and the links between First Nations human rights and the preservation of the environment.
And as she said to you, you know, I'm continuing. There are other fights.
Mm.
And Antoinette, I think it is only fair to us all, that we know what your next fight is going to be about. Could we just have some warning?
To be honest, what I would love to do is just to be able to use my skills as a communicator, as a thinker, as a journalist, as a commentator, without having to use it all in self-defense. It would be lovely just to be able to thrive and not be in a position where I have to, when I'm in sort of flight or fight mode, which I have been for 2.5 years. So I'm part of an independent media company that I started with Jan Fran. She's also a former ABC and SBS presenter and journalist. And we're hoping just to connect with audiences and equip them with more media literacy and critical thinking skills to navigate the plethora of information that we see on social media and across different media ecosystems. And I would really love to do that without much incident. David, if that's okay, I would love to do it without too much drama.
It's not going to happen. I mean, I've seen your work. It's tough. It's tough. It's fighting, and you'll get into lots of trouble. And we'll follow it all with glee.
Probably. Yeah.
And you'll pursue it with glee too, I suspect.
Yes, sometimes you can't help but be yourself, and that was that's a theme as well of a lot of the women in this book. They were just being themselves, and then often they were underestimated.
Thanks for joining us on the show.
Thank you so much.
I've been talking to Antoinette Latouf about her very interesting book, just published, Women Who Win, Celebrating Courage, Conviction and Change. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, Australia at Cannes. They bowed to her, and so they should. Joan Collins, at the age of 92, staggering along the red carpet at Cannes yesterday, wearing what looked like an enormous white magnolia. She had a man on each arm holding her upright, diamonds on her neck, not a wrinkle in her cheeks, inch-long eyelashes, pitch-black hair, a work of art. Cannes is one of about 13,000 film festivals around the world, but it's the one that matters most to the industry, in part for what's shown on big screens around the town, but perhaps more for contacts made and deals done. This is the 50th anniversary of Australia officially setting up shop in Cannes, in a splendid penthouse at the time, overlooking the Croisette. But the celebrations, if any, are rather muted this year, for we have no Australian film in this festival in competition. Australia's role at Cannes is the subject of a documentary John Doggett Williams has been working on for the last 10 years. He joins us now from the festival. John, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, David.
John, describe the view out the window. What's happening on the Croisette right now? Are elderly actresses staggering along the footpaths?
No, I'm looking at the beach and there's, you know, as usual, there's five or six photo shoots going on and there's people in bikinis. There's other casual tourists just having a swim in the splendid Côte d'Azur, warm waters there, and on the horizon, not very far away at all, is this multi-billionaire's yacht.
I was so hoping there would be yachts.
There's not many, actually. There's one or two. This thing's got three huge masts, and I'm told it's some Chinese tech billionaire, someone that started up something like TikTok.
Oh, how exciting. Hey, now look, yes, John, why do we have nothing ourselves in competition? Were works entered but not accepted? What's the situation?
The answers that I get are often there's films that could have been in but they weren't finished in time and you don't want to rush them just to get it into competition in Cannes. The other one is that people like Warwick Thornton, who just released Wolfram, was accepted into Berlin, I think, or Venice Film Festival. And once it screened somewhere else, especially Cannes' arch enemies, Venice and Berlin, then it's ineligible to be screened in competition in Cannes.
Why is there a Cannes Festival anyway? What's the history here?
The history is that it originally started as a reaction to the Venice Biennale Film Festival, which was started in the early 1930s, and it was set up under the charter of fascist cultural policy under Mussolini. And, of course, the democratic countries, Britain, France, the United States, strongly objected to the tone and types of films that were being winning awards there, especially since they weren't their own. And the last straw was in 1938, Leni Riefenstahl's Olympia, her film about the 1936 Olympics, which was, when you look back at it now, was stunning, but at the time must have been absolutely horrifying and terrifying for the portrayal of Hitler as a god, I suppose.
Yes, we've discussed Riefenstahl on the show. A very interesting situation. Anyway, Olympia won, did it?
Yeah, it won, and in the immediate reaction was that Britain and the US quit the festival and France strongly objected. So their immediate reaction was to have their own film festival, and Cannes, the local council, lobbied very hard for it and provided money. And so they launched their festival on the unfortunate date of the 1st of September 1939, which, as people who are aware of it know, that Germany marched into Poland. World War II was declared 2 days later. So the...
To use a film term, it pulled focus.
So apparently on the day that it was cancelled, there was an ocean liner full of American film stars, you know, that sort of just turned around and didn't even stop. But post-war, they tried again in 1946, and it was a much quieter place, and France was rebuilding post-war, and they wanted a free festival, free in the sense of democratically focused, and... they tried again in 1946.
But now, Australia had its first film within 10 years, Jeddah. How did it go?
What happened in those days was that films were nominated by a country. You could nominate one film from your country and they would accept it in competition. So Australia entered Jeddah, which was the first feature-length film filmed in colour and featuring Indigenous actors as in the lead parts, and it played. So Tagwali, who was the lead actor of Jeddah, was in the same category as Ernest Borgnine, James Dean, Spencer Tracy. And the story went was Tagwali was the only one that could really wrestle a crocodile and win.
Remarkable. Now, we did well in the early 70s, but then in 75... we decided to sort of officially join up. Now, what was that about? Renting the penthouse.
We got it from our dear friends, the Kiwis. Now, the penthouse, for those that don't know, is on the Croisette. And the Croisette is that mile-long road right next to the beach. And we had probably the best office on the Croisette. It was a penthouse. It was a large space. And very importantly, there was a huge Australian banner draped over the side of it. So everyone going down that had to go to the Carlton Hotel would walk past this great reminder that there was Australia at the top of the heap. And there'd be always people hanging over the side with a glass of wine in their hand, giving the impression that we were on high on the hog or important.
And this was where deals were done.
Yeah, yes, definitely deals were done. I mean, the purpose of the Australian Film Office is... to really, there's a cultural focus, but of course, commercial focus as well. So there'd be offices offered to producers or whoever needed them to workshop and meet prospective buyers of their films.
Philip Adams was leading the Australian delegation. Now, what was his role in promoting Australian film in Cannes?
He was our cultural ambassador. He was trying to do deals himself. He was trying to bring people in and be part of as many committees as he possibly could. And Philip really wrote the book. He wrote the initial paper that encouraged the Gorton government to set up.
We know.
He started, you know, so much. The Australian Film and Television School was directly came out of one of his initiatives. I mean, he realised that if you're going to make films, you needed people to know how to make them, which was a matter of debate early on.
What was the best we've ever done at Cannes?
Well, I suppose The Piano in 1993 won the Palme d'Or. Jane Campion, who very much identifies herself as a New Zealand director, and she was also the first woman to do that. It was a monumental feat. I mean, there's so many countries that go to Cannes. The politics are indescribable. The jury has many times been accused of corruption, of getting it wrong. But it's gone, went down in history as she was the first woman director to take it out. But that era in the early 90s, that was our second wave, our halcyon days.
Now, John, you've been working for all these years on a documentary about Australia in Cannes. And you've come, as I understand it, you've just come from the Australian breakfast. Now, what did you learn at that breakfast about our role in Cannes and indeed about the state of things in the Australian film industry?
Yes, there are about 140 people here. And sadly, it's a sign of the times. So it's pretty well the only organised event where people, the Australians themselves, will be here en masse. I mean, this is very different from the past decades. Where we used to have gala balls, hundreds of people coming to them, living high on the hog. People who are here are pretty well optimistic. You have to come to Cannes, where you meet people face-to-face and you can do deals. But as we were saying, there's no films in competition, but there's signs of life in other places, such as this year at Sundance, we had seven films that were accepted and there's a feeling that we've done well at Sundance and we've done very well then. There's another important film festival, South by Southwest, that's in Texas. In 2024, we had an unprecedented 11 films in competition. So they're sort of youth-orientated markets to an extent. But Cannes itself, walking down the Croisette, it's the most underwhelmed that I've seen it. I mean, there's nowhere near the traffic that there was 10 years ago here.
Yes, the atmosphere is not as carnival, but what about the selection of films for the competition and for the director's fortnight? Are you seeing a different kind of film?
I think there's only two English-speaking films out of the 19 that are in competition this year, and there's a much stronger focus on Europe and Africa. There's a Guatemalan film that's made competition and a Cypriot film. So it's quite a different direction that they've been taking. There's also a strange thing where they've modified the dress on the red carpets.
What?
Yes, they don't like sheer nude-looking outfits.
No flesh?
Not as much.
That's a big change. Think what Joan Collins could have been wearing but for that rule.
The reason that I'm so dedicated to sort of pursuing this subject is that it's totally fascinating. I mean, Cannes itself is stunning. You can't change the weather or the atmosphere. It's just pristine. You know, in the 1880s, Renoir and Monet would frequently come here for holidays.
For the light.
Yes, and they obviously painted it many, many times. And over the 20th century, the growth of the wedding cake hotels, they gave it an atmosphere, and you can't beat the Croisette, you know, a mile-long walk. It's ready made for theatrical production.
Well, John, get out there onto the Croisette, and thank you. Thank you for taking a few minutes to join us on Late Night Live.
Thank you.
I've been talking to John Doggett Williams, freelance video journalist and documentary maker who is at his 10th Cannes Festival. And that's the show. On our next, we're looking at how war shapes the food nations eat. Food, so often an early casualty of fighting and displacement.